Morning, my name is David.
Hey, David.
And I'm a grateful Al-Anon. Really grateful to be here today. It's a little odd to share. I've been coming down here for 8.5 years, and it's always been really easy for me to share because I've always had some kind of catastrophe going on in my life, and I just spoke to that. And so it just, you know, and now it's this is a lot more intimidating because life is good. Life is really good, and I almost don't know what to say. Like, it's a Al-Anon's worst moment is when they don't have anything to complain about, right? life's really good. So all I can really do is tell you my story. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. Born and raised there to a single mom who was very, very stressed and drank a lot and had one brother. So there's just three of us. We were a small family. My joke today is always that I come from a small family. There's just three of us and the other two aren't talking. And that's how it's been. You know, we just have had a hard time at it. I mean, we were never really, I think, what most people would consider a family. We grew up in the, you know, we lived in the same house. I grew up in that house. There's a lot of alcohol consumption. There's a lot of abuse. I don't know how else to say it. I've been abused in every way that abuse has been categorized. And I think it's just part of the story of growing up in an alcoholic home like that. My mom was really into partying. She was really interested in her friends. She was really interested in men. And I think, you know, she was overwhelmed with two boys. She didn't know what to do. So, you know, I mean, we do our best with what we have, right? And her thing was really to drink. And my thing was to be quiet. Because I learned, like, you know, if I made any noise or if I had a need or a problem, then that led to bad things. So I, best way I can say it is I just learned how to be very quiet, learned how to be invisible, learned how to have a very small footprint in this world. And so I didn't grow up with much of a voice, you know. And then as I wound up in situations, social situations or work situations or school or whatever, I didn't have a voice, and I was so perplexed at why I didn't have a voice. Well, you know, I just perfected the art of camouflage my whole life. It was sort of a survival technique. So as the years grew, I got abused pretty badly, and it sort of set a victim's mentality in my mind. I don't know if anyone's ever experienced that. I'm sure someone in here has. I just was really good at being a victim. I could almost coax you into victimizing me. It's just crazy. When I was about 9 years old, I got my back broken by a boy's fist. And it just sort of epitomized everything that I, you know, that I had sort of experienced at that point. But every time you experience abuse and there's no outlet, I just think it's normal. This stuff builds up. It builds up, and I was becoming, even though I was a very meek, shy kid, I was becoming very, very angry. And eventually, I got out of there. My back got broken, but I never, I had 2 vertebrae get fractured. I didn't know that at the time. All I knew is it hurt like hell, and I can't even describe the pain or the convulsions I was in for a while, but eventually I stood up and walked away from it. And my back was altered. I was always in pain. I just sort of adjusted. I wasn't from the kind of family where you were taken to the doctor, so I just sort of adjusted to it, you know. When I was 18, I enlisted in the United States Air Force, and they put you all through these medical, you know, exams. They x-rayed my back, and they pulled me out, and they said, you can't come in the Air Force. You've got a fractured back. And I'm like, what? And so, you know, I desperately wanted to go on the service at the time because I felt like I didn't have any other options. So the medical director came out and he said, well, have you ever had any back problems? And I said, I lied. You know, I lied through my teeth. I said, no. The truth is I lived in, you know, excruciating pain, and I just sort of adjusted the way I stood and the way I moved and just dealt with it like I dealt with everything. So he thought maybe it was a problem with the x-ray machine, so they did the x-ray with another machine. They couldn't figure out how I was standing there with fractures in my back. And so it was 10 years from the time that happened to me realizing that, you know, and seeing it. Seeing the x-ray was really weird. So he didn't know what to do, and I lied through my teeth. And I had learned a lot about manipulation and dishonesty, so I worked him pretty good. I told him, you know, I'm a strong young man. I want to serve my country. You're going to keep me from doing that? And so he gave me, he said, okay, I'm going to give you a strength test, and if you pass the strength test, then I'll let you in. And somehow, through the grace of God, I barely passed that strength test. And so I went on in the service. I wound up in Japan, stationed in Japan, and I'd always dreamed of, so I'd been beat up so much and abused so much, I'd always dreamed of knowing how to defend myself. So there I was in Japan, which is the birthplace of martial arts, and I thought, well, that's perfect. So I started going to martial arts classes, and then shortly I became an amateur fighter over there. And, you know, I was so outclassed athletically. These guys were usually bigger, they're faster, they're just, I don't know, better genetics or something. But I was so angry that I almost felt sorry for these guys. You know, I'd get in the ring and I remember thinking, dude, you have no idea what you're in for, you know. And I did quite well. But over 3 years of that, what I realized is that, you know, I wasn't any less angry 3 years of fighting later. In fact, I think I had grown the anger. Today, I think, you know, whatever I put my energy into grows, right? I learned that here. And so I just sort of drifted from that. Wound up falling in love when I was 24. And to a wonderful, intelligent, beautiful, tan, blonde, fun, really intelligent woman who happened to be an alcoholic. And I never, you know, we had a lot of fun together. I came from a lot of alcohol. She came from a lot of alcohol. We were sort of a match made in heaven. I mean, we had a lot of fun for about 5 years. Through our 20s, we pretty much had what everybody wanted. And then we got pregnant. And so there's this really important shift that happened for me where, you know, I mean, you get pregnant for the first time and it's pretty overwhelming. You're going to be a parent, so it's going through all those adjustments. And I just knew, I thought it was just common knowledge that it was time to stop drinking, stop partying, start saving a little money, and start, you know, changing diapers and being a parent. So I made that shift, and she did not. She didn't make the shift. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about addiction. I made all the classic Al-Anon mistakes. I thought that her behavior was detestable. I thought it was indicative of poor discipline. You know, come on, get your discipline together. Stop drinking. I thought it was selfish, and I thought it was dishonest, and I thought she was sort of reneging on a lot of our commitment to each other, because there I was now with this child, and I was taking care of him all the time, and she was drinking. I was like, well, you know, I didn't really sign up for that, but I wasn't going to not take care of that child, right? So in very short order, we had a second kid. We had two boys 14 months apart, and it was exhausting, you know. I mean, I didn't really come from a family where I saw a lot of that stuff, so probably nobody knows what they're doing at that age, but I really didn't know what I was doing either. And I grew increasingly irritated that I was doing it on my own. Yeah, really, really pissed. And so, like a lot of Al-Anons, you know, I tried to do a lot of different things to get her to get on board, to put the wine down and to pick the kid up, you know. I tried yelling, I tried pleading, I tried crying, I tried threatening, I tried lying, I tried drinking with her, I tried not drinking with her. I've got a very long list of stuff I tried, and I guess I walked in here because none of that stuff ever worked for me. If anybody ever figured out how to get their alcoholic and stop drinking, I'd love to hear that story. And so then a few years later, we had a third child, a daughter. So then I had three kids. I ran a little business, and I was trying to keep that alive. Along with the drinking was a lot of spending money that we shouldn't be spending, and other stuff just got us in trouble. We were always in trouble with something. We were in trouble with our taxes. We were in trouble with some neighbor. We were in trouble with kids, you know, whatever, the school. There was always some drama. And what I can say is that all that was kind of familiar to me. I didn't like it, but I did come from a lot of sick drama and drinking, so it was familiar. And it wasn't until I was in this program, somebody suggested to me that maybe, you know, I was attracted to her because she was an alcoholic, and I thought, well, that's preposterous, you know. A few years in the program, I would realize that, yeah, if a woman is an alcoholic, I'm probably attracted to her. And a few years later, I realized if she's a narcissist, she's really hot. So it's been really striking to me that, you know, like, intellectually I can know something's bad for me. But if it's familiar, that there's a real pull to that, you know? That familiar, I mean, if I'm not paying attention, that's where I'm going to wind up. I'm going to wind up with my wheels in that rut in the road because that's where I always drive. And so this program has been like this practice of proactive decisions, adult-like decisions to try to do things differently. One of the things that I just had a really hard time with was telling my wife no. Just couldn't tell her no, you know. I would come down here and complain that she was drinking, and then I would go pick up her wine when she wanted me to pick up her wine. It's like, what am I? Not a consistent message at all. But I think I had been abandoned and abused a lot in my life, so I think more than anything I was afraid of upsetting someone to the point where they would leave me. And I guess for my mindset, you know, it didn't take much to make someone leave me. So I have been at times really petrified of displeasing people. When I displease people, really bad things happen. And, you know, I've just learned that about my pathology. So it's a really big deal. It may not be everybody's story here, but it's a really big deal for me to learn how to say no. So I want to tell you about my first no. My first no is hilarious. My boys were young and they were playing with boy toys and they had this little gun. And this gun was extremely realistic looking. Like, it freaked me out. It looked like a Glock. It was designed to look like a Glock millimeter handgun. And I was like, wow, that was really realistic. But it had the little toy, like Hasbro or something, name on it, you know. And during that time, I was coming down here, and my sponsor was saying, look, you've got to learn to, you know, stick up for yourself, and you got to not be afraid of displeasing people, right? Just make your choices and let their feelings be theirs. This was all really foreign to me. So I go to Austin with a couple of friends of mine. We're down at 6th Street. We go to this pub for this event. We had a good time. We come out. We go down this dark alley to go to our cars. And this guy jumps out of the shadows with a gun and sticks us up. He says, give me your wallets. And I look down at his gun, and his gun was this Hasbro gun. It was the exact gun. And I had seen it a million times. I mean, there was no doubt. So there was absolutely no fear of getting shot for me. And there were three of us, and there were one of him, you know. So he said, give me your wallets. And my two friends gave him their wallets. And he turned to me and he said, give me your wallet. And I said, give me your wallet. And, you know, that's not the script, right? He was confused and irritated. And my friends were confused and irritated. They're like, give him your wallet. You know? I'm like, you don't give my friends back their wallet, I'm going to stick that Hasbro gun up your butt so far. And so it's not that I haven't ever said no to people. I say it like that, it's funny. That wasn't my first no, but that was like what I consider my first recovery no, because there was this conversation in my head. And so here's why I tell you that story, and this is maybe not so funny. Even knowing absolutely that was a toy gun, I almost gave that guy my wallet. Since that's the Al-Anon disease. I don't want to disrupt this. No one's going to understand my reaction. I don't want to displease him. Maybe he'll get upset and try to hit me, or maybe, like, whatever. The script goes on. But there was an active conversation in my head that, luckily, thanks to this place, wasn't taking place in my head before I just gave him my wallet. I guarantee you, even if I knew that was a toy gun, I would have given him my wallet before program. But now I've got this choice to make, like, okay, maybe I can do this differently. It feels awkward and weird. I know he's going to be upset. give me your wallet. I've also heard a lot of people talk about aha moments here. It's great aha moments. Some spiritual clarity happens or some connection with their higher power. I had a lot of unrecovered aha moments. My aha moments were, aha, I caught you drinking again. Or, aha, there's Merlot in that Diet Pepsi can, isn't there? It was so incredibly important to me to be right. And amongst the two of us, to be the more righteous one, by the way. I was just in love with being right. And that just never got me anywhere. Well, it got me here. and I'm grateful for that. But, you know, that's the kind of thinking that has had to go away. Just don't really care so much about classifying things as right or wrong. And so a lot of the normie friends that I've had have just sort of drifted over the years. You know, I've got a lot of friends down here. Most of my friends are program friends because I don't think the outside world is prepared all the time for this kind of thinking, you know. Yeah, it's really odd. I was telling a story the other night where I had this phase in recovery where I had a lot of normie friends and I had made a lot of program friends, and I was getting advice from both of them simultaneously on my problems with my marriage. And of course, all my normie friends were telling me what I wanted to hear, right? God, you're right, man. She's terrible. You're right and she's wrong and she shouldn't be doing that, and all the things that my ego wanted to hear. But I also knew I'd been doing that for years and years and years, and it wouldn't make anything any better. Then I had program friends over here telling me, well, you know, what kind of choices are you prepared to make? Or how do you feel about that? You know, or do you have a part in that? Are you prepared to say no? Or, you know, are you part of this system? I remember my sponsor telling me one time when my wife was getting really bad. It's a progressive disease, alcoholism, and I watched her progress. He said, you know, David, no one can get this sick on their own. And I was like, well, you know, what am I supposed to do? You know, I was petrified of leaving her. So I was so afraid of being alone and being abandoned. I just couldn't imagine leaving her. Plus, we had these three kids, and I thought, you know, my three kids are going to live that divorced life that I lived. That's not very good. And some bold person on my Tuesday night suggested that maybe my kids would actually be in a better position if I left. And I started thinking about that. I was always telling my kids how to feel about their mom's drinking. I was always coming to meetings and then going home and preaching to them like I was going to be the one, you know, that was going to give them the great message or whatever. And what I can tell you is it wasn't working. My sponsor suggested something really painfully obvious. He said, why don't you ask your kids how they feel? And I went, God, have I never done that? You know, as they were getting older, they had all kinds of thoughts and feelings. And I realized I was so busy trying to tell them how to feel, I never asked them how they felt. And that maybe that's a great view of Al-Anonism. I'm going to fix it. I don't care what you think. I'm going to fix you. If you, whatever. So shortly after I started, I had each of my kids alone, and I asked them how they felt. And, of course, all this stuff came out of all of them. It was just amazing. And my relationship has been so rich with them, really ever since then. I didn't have a bad relationship with them before, but it wasn't as good as it could have been. And so the four of us, me and the three kids, you know, we've just always had this understanding since that time that we're in this together, you know. We're in this together, we're going to help each other get what we need, and we're going to navigate the difficulties of an alcoholic in the family. And it's a huge problem with my wife drinking and driving, and drinking and driving our kids. It was just a horrendous problem, and I controlled it the best that I could for as long as I could. But, you know, I could never keep them 100% safe, and that just was unacceptable to me. Her drinking progressed, and at some point, I convinced her to go to rehab. I got her to go to rehab, so you knew that was going to work. And it did. It worked for 9 days. $8,000 copay for 9 days of sobriety, and actually I think it was maybe the best money I ever spent, because I got to see all these theories that I was being taught realized. Like, the theory is that there's this person, this real, live, wonderful, beautiful person, And this disease of alcoholism is like a shroud over top of them. So it's what you're seeing, but it's not really them. So my sponsor and others were teaching me how to separate the ick from the ism, you know, the person from the disease. And so when she went to rehab, I saw that shroud come up, and I saw the old Jenny. It was amazing. And then 9 days later, the shroud went back down. But it was like this great, valuable moment that, you know, these things I was learning weren't just theory. They were really, really true. And she's really in there. She behaves terribly, just like probably any other active alcoholic. You know, she lies and cheats and steals and manipulates, and she does everything she can. She's come in and out of sort of admission of a problem. She's come in and out of here. I think she used to come here to drink, she told me at one point. So whatever. But eventually, you know, her disease progressed. It got so ridiculous. Everything was so out of hand. And then she got into drugs. And I found crystal meth on my floor. And it was this, I didn't know anything about drugs. I know a lot about drugs now. but they package it, and this packaging called candy meth, where they present it as candy, but it's laced in meth. And so I had candy meth in a house with three candy-eating children, right? And that was it. That was it. So I filed for divorce, and what I can tell you without going on and on and on about it is that I spent a very long, very expensive, very taxing, very scary, very triggering 3-year divorce battle, child custody battle. It took just about everything I thought I had. My lawyer charged $300 an hour, her lawyer charged $300 an hour, so it cost $100 to have a 10-minute argument, and you know, we had plenty of those, so the lawyers loved it. I developed a lot of really strong opinions on our family law system. And, you know, it was like the next level of letting go for me. I had to let go of the alcoholic, and then I had to let go of this system, of this sense of justice. Like, go to the justice system, and there's no justice in it. It's just a financial transaction. But what I can say is eventually I let go enough to navigate all that. And because I learned how to take care of myself in here, I took care of myself through that process. I got attacked and grilled by lawyers in court so many times in so many ways. Such horrendous things, you know. I was accused of being a child beater and a child molester and anything else they could come up with. There was no evidence of these things, but, you know, they charged $300 an hour, so they want to fill the day with a lot of stuff. At one point, I was being cross-examined on the stand by her lawyer, who was a pit bull. Really, the only thing you didn't know about him is that his specialty was not family law. His specialty was personal injury. He was really, really aggressive and just really, yeah. He was an Al-Anon's nightmare, really. And so he was grilling me on the stand, and every time he asked me a question, it wasn't really a question, it was a statement. And he wouldn't let me finish talking, and, you know, I'd start talking, and he'd shoot the next one at me. So I just stopped answering him. I just put it in God's hands. I thought, you know, if the judge has a problem with this, then the judge will direct me. But I just stopped answering him. And finally, he said, "You have a problem, Mr. Greenlee?" And I said, "Yeah, Mr. So-and-so. I just want to know if you're going to ask me the questions and give me the answers. Do I have to be here?" And the judge kind of rolled her eyes, you know. And it's just sort of my way, you know, this way I've learned of just saying enough is enough, you know. None of that, all that legal crap and all the expense of it, it didn't change the fact that my ex-wife now is an alcoholic. It didn't change the fact that I was the primary parent and always had been. It cost a lot of money, so my next big challenge and fear was just running out of resources. But I did survive it, and I wound up in a great house with my kids. I got custody of my kids, and I get to see their mom, and everything's relatively safe for them. When it's not, I intervene. And so life is just like all that drama is over. It's just amazing. I wind up in a new house with a new job and a new life. I did lose my business along the way, but I think actually maybe it needed to go. I accepted a really good job just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, it's, I've got that eerie sense of what do I do now? Like, so I find myself with a few sponsees, and you know, trying to pay it forward. I've been here 8.5 years, and you know, it used to be hard to talk about any of this stuff without prying, so that's a really cool development. I met one of my sponsees. I think he's in the room here today, so I'll probably embarrass him, but I met him several weeks back or a couple months ago. We had lunch, and we were working together a little bit. At one point, he excused himself to go to the bathroom, and when he came back to the table, he said, "Sorry about that." And I smiled, and I said, "Only an Al-Anon would apologize for going to the bathroom." So, anyway, I can pass the message forward, you know. And so I manage this crap in myself still. It's still there, but I'm a lot better about managing it. I can tell you, this place has changed my life. I walked in here, I dragged myself in here. And everything that was told to me was exactly opposite of what I wanted to hear and what I thought would work. But there was this undeniable reality that what I was doing wasn't working. So, you know, when you get to that point, you might as well try something differently. You know, I'm just so incredibly grateful. Whenever I cry in meetings now, it's out of gratitude. It's not so much out of self-pity or the fear of everything. It's just this amazing gratitude I have for all these people in this program. My sponsor is a guy that... you know, he's just got a certain bluntness and truth about him, and he can see me coming about a half a mile away. I mean, it's just nothing I can trick him on, man. So when I came in here, I just want to say in closing that I was one of those people that felt I was the only one. We call it being terminally unique, and I really thought I was the only one. I was surprised there was a meeting for people like me. I thought maybe there were one or two other people, not like this. And I was so encouraged to find that I wasn't alone. I want to say, you know, the very first word of the 12 steps is we. The second to last word is our. And the words we or our or us is repeated 18 times in the 12 steps. I've always known that about this place. So if you're new here today, I want to welcome you. Or if you've been coming here for a while and you still feel alone, I want to welcome you. Thanks.
Thank you.